This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Bob Miller. He's the president and actually founder of Flatiron Books, which is an imprint of Macmillan.
That's true. That is all true.
Yeah. Well, but you've been, that's been for about 5 years.
5 years, that's right.
Officially,
yep.
Right? I think it could have been August 1st, 2013.
You're close. You're very close. Yeah. Frighteningly close.
We're almost at 5 year anniversary.
Yes.
But before that, you've been in publishing for many years. Not many, many years, but many years.
It's actually 40 years, if I want to feel old.
That's pretty many.
I can say that number now.
Yeah. I'm a little bit ahead of you, which I don't want to discuss.
Okay.
But
we don't have to.
You know, we don't have to compete.
No.
But you started out in publishing as an editor.
I was an editorial assistant, which is a typical way to start out,
yep,
at St. Martin's Press,
yep,
which happens to be in the Flatiron Building, to which I've returned in this current enterprise.
And of course, Flatiron. When I think I talked to you when you had first taken the job, before you had the name for Flatiron,
right?
And you went through a process of trying to figure out what to call it. I am curious. I know you ended up with a sort of obvious name for the press, but how did you get there?
Well, I always from the beginning wanted to call it Flatiron Books because my first 8 years in publishing, I'd been in that building, and here I was after having done a bunch of other stuff, coming back to that building, which is so iconic. And I said to John Sargent, the CEO of the company, I said, I know what I want to call it, Flatiron Books. He said, oh, you can't call it that. people have wanted to call things Flatiron Books around here for a long time. It's an obvious choice. But there was a guy named Harry Newton, who for 27 years, I think it was, had self-published a Harry Newton's Telecommunications Dictionary, like an 800 or 900-page dictionary of telecommunications terms that he had published under the name Flatiron Books and done 27 revised editions of. So he had a common law trademark.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed to hear that. I started looking around for other names. And, you know, now with all the self-publishing, with everybody even with publishing one book,
every
there
name
are very
possible,
few
yes,
words that haven't been claimed.
Yes.
And I really was having a hard time letting go of the Flatiron Books name. So I started trying to reach Harry Newton. And Harry eventually got back to me. And we had a couple months before I started of a dialogue that went back and forth. And at first he was reluctant because, you know, he still had his dictionary being published under that name, but sales had slowed down because dictionaries not being what they are were before the internet.
Right.
And he was getting on, and eventually we, make a long story short, we worked it out.
Right.
And he had the URL and he had the name, and I was really happy to be able to have that be the name.
And this actually is a good discussion point. The brand name of a publisher in publishing is in some ways, you know, there's always arguments about the brand value. What does a publisher mean? Mm. Does the consumer notice? And my sense is the consumer does not notice.
No.
But it's important within the book industry. The brand name does have meaning.
I mean, I think there are some exceptions, the Penguin Classics or vintage paperbacks I have tried. There's, you know, there's Harlequin certainly for romance, a Tor for science fiction, a Minotaur for hardcore mystery readers. You know, I think that these publishers that specialize in a certain area,
then the brand
and
does
have earned
value.
A credibility over time.
Yes.
And Knopf and Scribner and some of the publishers that have been around for a long time, winning lots of awards, and Forrest, Russ, and Drew certainly with other Nobel Prize winners. I mean, that has emanated. You know, that's reached consumers to some degree, but to a much larger extent, consumers just are looking for a certain book. So it's usually meaningless to the consumer, but it is very meaningful to the media and to booksellers because it's a form of accumulated credibility.
Right.
So, like, if you're a publisher that has published a certain kind of book well in the past, out of all the books that are being pitched every day, which ones do you trust to be what people say they are?
Right.
And so what you're trying to build and capitalize on is credibility. And for a startup, obviously you don't have that except in the staff that's come together to
and
do
the books.
This. Yeah, well,
gradually over time,
but it's only we're in our fourth full year of publishing, yeah. So we've built that up to some extent, but not like a company that's been around for decades.
Right. But that kind of is the entry point to discussing how did you envision Flatiron as a publisher, because the books you publish create the brand in a sense over time.
Right. Well, the idea originally was to do a small number of books with a lot of effort and marketing put into each. That was mm-hmm. the general model, the many eggs in each basket approach.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all different kinds of models of publishing, and there's no rule about, you know, which model succeeds or fails. But at this stage of my career, it's certainly the most gratifying thing to be able to spend more time on each book. So the idea that I discussed with John Sargent 5 years ago was, how about an imprint that's, you know, a relatively smaller number of titles with a experienced staff putting a lot to bet in, on each one. And he liked that idea. But when we started, it was going to be just 8 or 10 people doing 2 books a month, all nonfiction, because that's what I had most experience with over time editorially. It's also what you can start a new company with, because you don't have authors.
Right.
You look for ideas, perhaps with authors who are less well known. And, you know, if you pick the right ideas, you can hopefully get started with nonfiction. But nonfiction over time tends to be a harder way to build repeat authorship. Generally speaking, fiction is what repeats over time. People say, oh, I want the new novel by John Grisham or whoever. And nonfiction tends to not be as repetitive. But it's a good way to get started. And the very lucky thing that happened was not only having him say, yes, let's do that, which was critical, but then right when it was announced, I heard from Amy Einhorn, who's one of a handful of the best fiction editors in the business. She edits nonfiction as well, but very well known for her fiction. Over many jobs, the most recently having been her own imprint, Amy Einhorn Books, which had the first book she published in that imprint was The Help, mm-hmm. the first novel that did pretty well.
Yep.
And then she built Leon Moriarty from an unknown to The Husband's Secrets and Big Little Lies, an enormous success. And she had many other successes along the way, The Postmistress by Sarah Blake and on and on. So really one of the most capable and credible people in the business. And she came to me and said, you're focused on nonfiction primarily. I'm focused on fiction primarily. What if we join forces in this new venture? And it was, I knew from having spent 18 years growing a company called Hyperion for Disney that what I hadn't done enough of, or we hadn't done enough of in that company, was build repeat authorship through a fiction program. So having Amy as my partner, the first year was just the nonfiction, but she came on a year in, and that to have both, and we're doing now, and we'd like to keep it to this number, 48 books a year, half fiction, half nonfiction. Mm-hmm. It's about roughly 4 books a month.
That's a fairly hefty list.
But it's to have, we have 24 people now who are focused on those 48, and publishing now, there are a lot of very strong editors, but they tend to then behind the scenes be sharing resources such as marketing, publicity, and mm-hmm. art, and so on. And we're lucky to, under this structure, while that's many fewer books than actually most divisions that are full divisions as opposed to editorial imprints have, we have our own 5-person publicity department, our own 4-person marketing department, our own 3-person art department, our own, then all of our editorial staff. And having that all be completely people who are working only on Flatiron
right.
is actually a wonderful advantage given that size.
Right. And it gives you focus.
Yeah.
And dedication to those books.
Yeah.
Whereas if they were being shared,
it's enough books that people have plenty to do, but it's not so much that we don't all know pretty much what's going on with right. all of them, which I like. I mean, a bigger list, you can really only focus and know everything that's happening on maybe two or three books a month.
Is your sense that the strategy of publishing fewer books and the idea of focusing more attention on them, it's not just in the moment, but it's over time?
Exactly.
I take it that you would be, and you've talked about that in terms of repeat authors, that the idea is that you are working in the brand space, kind of, to put it in that kind of terminology. Well, but just that the books, that something that is valuable to a book today will have value accreted to future books.
Exactly. That's one way that the focus on growing a list is important, because the money you spend and the time you spend on new material, you're betting will pay off years down the line, where you're building not only backlist but repeat authorship. But in individual books as well, what you really are hoping is that you'll have more time and that your staff will have more time to do work on the book before it's published,
right,
and after it's published, because stretching that time frame out beyond the 2 weeks that a book, you know, it lands and the publicity department is all focused on it and then the next books are coming down the pike, it's like that Lucille Ball episode with the chocolates coming down the assembly line. And you can have great, and that approach can have great success and generate a lot of revenue over a lot of titles and have more chances to win, more lottery tickets being purchased in terms of book bets. But it also can be frustrating, because if you have found any really good book, you could really only do that one book all year. Because if a book is really good, it could easily benefit from having 24 people do nothing but publish that book for a whole year.
Well, and isn't your sense – I mean, my sense right now is that also there's an advantage in the landscape having changed a bit, that it used to be that if you did not get success right away, a book would be dead. It would be invisible because when it was a bricks and mortar world, the books would be off the shelf for the next new wave of books coming in. You only had a certain amount of time. In an online world where we are not only selling bricks and mortar, but you know the door is always open in online, the shelf is never bare, and you're never replaced. It gives you the opportunity to work on a book for a long period of time.
So a good example is a book called The Dry, which this past weekend down at BoucherCon won the Barry Award, which is a great award in that mystery world. This is a first mystery from Australia that we published, I guess it was 2 years ago, and really put a lot into in the way that our model would, you know, imply. And it was a New York Times bestseller in hardcover. But of course, that has a window where a book gets attention and sells, and it did really well, got great reviews. But the ongoing sale of it as an ebook, first the paperback and the ebook and the audio, are formats that we keep promoting, doing price promotions on and on. We've sold now beyond the initial tens of thousands. We've sold hundreds of thousands since we were initially published. Right. And we have just published her second book, Force of Nature, and we have our third book coming next year. So that's a good example of what you're talking about.
Right.
But on the other side of it, the pre-publication work has also, because of the higher percentage of online bookselling, become really important, because online booksellers will order a number of copies to a large degree based on pre-orders, and getting those pre-orders accumulated ahead of publications that all then release in that first week and, you know, get you on the bestseller list if possible, that's a really big focus. So we start a year ahead, drum rolling to that, to the consumer. And we used to, you know, just have the retailer we would pitch to, and then have the retailer hopefully pitch to the customer. Now we're still pitching to retailers, but we're also drum rolling to the consumer to pre-order it and or be aware of it.
Talk about it
on social media.
Get excited about it, yes. And in fact, that's another advantage of the online retail marketplace. It used to be a kind of a sine qua non, do not market a book that you can't sell today.
Right.
If it's not available, You can't. But the, now you want it to be back-ordered, essentially.
You want the pre-orders, and you want the buzz going into it, and that's a really big part of this, the effort. And it starts, you know, the thinking and even some of the outreach starts up to a year ahead. In the couple months beforehand, a pre-order strategy and the young adult market, and we publish young adult within our list, is especially voraciously aware of what's coming down the pike.
Right.
And they're aware of our editor, Sarah Barley, who's gotten her own reputation in that world, and which, in as is appropriate to our model, she's doing maybe 4 to 6 books a year as opposed to most editors that might do 20 or 25. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But each one of those she's choosing from hundreds that she's read, and we are putting a lot behind. And the pre-order campaigns for these books are really significant, and it's been paying off. We had a first novel Sarah had acquired called Caraval by Stephanie Garber that we happily made into a New York Times bestseller, and the second book in that now trilogy, Legendary, was just published and was a New York Times bestseller. Same thing with a first novel called The Hazelwood, which has spent 31 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. So, but that doesn't just happen overnight.
Right.
It only happens with a lot of things going right and a lot of people reading the book and getting excited about it and talking about it ahead of time and pre-ordering it. And it starts 3, 6, 9 months ahead.
And that's actually what you just described is interesting, that rarely, except in YA and sci-fi and fantasy, maybe mystery, do the editors become personae.
Right.
Famously maybe Otto Penzler as a mystery maven, essentially. But rarely, you know, it's actually fairly unusual for an editor to have a reputation.
Right. Well, those community, the ones that are, as Sarah is, a very active on social media, you know, talking about what books they like, and it's a very generous community, and they all are aware of each other, and they're all touting each other's work. But it's just like in the foodie community, people are aware of chefs, not just restaurants.
Right. Right.
People know that, you know, people really in that community, booksellers and reviewers, know that Sarah has a very good eye, and she's had an unusually high hit rate. And she grew up in a bookstore and really knows what she likes and why.
Do you think, I mean, it never occurred to me to think of this, but do you think that the YA audience of today, which may be definably different from YA audiences of the past, you know, with not radically different, but somewhat different. Do you think that they're growing up to be adult readers, that they will be different in the way they behave as an audience, in the way what their expectations are of authors and editors and publishers?
I think, yeah, I think they'll want more to participate more and communicate more. They're very engaged. Yeah. They want to have a direct dialogue with the author. I mean, right. Today we published a book called The Dinner List, by an author who's known in the YA community from several books she wrote, but this is her first adult novel. And her name's Rebecca Searle, and she's very personable. And we had her go to all over the country to pre-sell dinners with booksellers. She's been doing all kinds of social media leading up to this. Today, she took over the Flatiron Instagram account, and you could see her, you could follow her through her day from her, from her coffee to her, the end of her day. And I think you're right that people who've grown up with YA and in the habit of being really engaged, feeling like they're part of the process, that's going to continue. And certainly Harry Potter was, game-changing for showing young people that how wonderful it was to read and the way the characters aged with the audience. And then you had Twilight and you had Hunger Games and the franchises that followed that, you know, to fill that appetite that had been built up, you know, John Green and so on, whether it's fantasy or realistic, as that audience grew up, that area of publishing has really exploded. And I think we will see books like The Rosie Project and hopefully The Dinner List, you know, kind of books that really cross over, are accessible to a young audience and speak to them, but that they can feel some personal connection to.
Right.
I think you're right.
And that makes me also wonder if as the, you know, as that carass, that group of people age together, you know, they become adult readers, adult writers instead of being the writer being categorized as YA, you know, that you know your own community better, but is it really that's your own age group? And as they get older, maybe you, maybe that'll change the way writers write over time.
Well, we have a very well-known young adult author named Leigh Bardugo writing a adult novel for us right now that we'll publish late next year. So I think a lot of the authors writing for a somewhat younger audience.
Yeah.
Although the books we're doing, we aren't doing middle grade. We're doing it's a young adult crossover audience that really anybody could read. And I think the number of adults, young or otherwise, who discovered this genre and how appealing it is.
Well, because also the writers, there are so many good writers who are in the so-called young adult category.
Yeah.
I know many adults who read those books as a matter of course because they're really good.
And then when they get that audience established, then they can try to write something that's a little older. Yeah. But it's, you know, there have been books all along that had young characters that we didn't call young adult. I mean, Catcher in the Rye, was that a YA novel? Published today, would you call it a YA novel?
Yeah, you might.
Or would you just call it a book with a young character? So this category, I think, does welcome adult readers. And I think that the readers in that category are age up with it.
Yeah. No, that's and that may be a new thing.
And they also they like hardcovers. They like print.
Yes.
So it's interesting because I think that age group, you would think, oh, they're young, though, just everything digital. But paradoxically, they spend so much of their time on screens that when they read a book,
yeah, they want the book to be a book.
That it's nice to have a break from screen.
I think that there's a certain amount of data. Maybe some of it is not real data, more, you know, people seeing how people behave. But there's a certain amount of information out there that indicates that screen-centric young people who like to read books want to read real books.
My kids only read physical books, and they like vinyl. So it's going the other way because I think there is a fatigue, a screen fatigue.
Well, it's also a kind of cultural rebellion against the screen-centric life, you know, and it's sort of like the artisanal food movement against against commodity, commodity life. You know, the book, the physical book as object and as beautiful object is really more important in a digital environment.
The you know, I think when the e-book shift happened, you know, starting a decade ago, whenever how long it's been, the assumption was across the board, oh, everything will go digital by, and then the predictions were either 10 years or 2 years or 2 months or 20 years, but it was going to happen. And you were kind of an idiot if you didn't think so. But what happened was different kinds of books sold very differently physically versus electronically.
Right.
And certainly books that people would buy several times a week and cared a lot about price, romances and mysteries, 80-90% electronic. But when you look at all adult fiction combined, including literary fiction, it's more like half and half. And then when you look at adult nonfiction, it's more like 80% physical.
Right.
All along. It never really happened in nonfiction. And then in illustrated books, children's books, practical nonfiction, cookbooks, crafts, less than 5%.
Yeah, and I think some of it may be the nature of reading in and of itself, that I think screen reading, even though I enjoy it and I read a ton of things on screen, is fatiguing.
Yeah.
Reading, it's convenient because when you move around, you don't have to carry, like we used to carry, you know, heavy numbers of books. Go on vacation, you'd be in bags of books, which I still do. But the experience of reading on a screen, whether it's, you know, whether it's literally the limitations of screen and eye, or that maybe ebooks have not evolved, it's possible.
And the same person can also like to maybe buy a new thriller electronically for a lower price, and it's not a book that they feel they need to keep on their shelf forever.
It's a consumer.
Whereas as a literary novel that has a certain physical beauty and lasting quality, they might want to buy physically, and a cookbook they want to give as a gift. You don't want to give as an ebook as a gift. So it really depends on the kind of book more than I think anybody knew when this started happening.
That's true.
But then over the last couple of years, we've seen a decline in ebooks as a format, and I think it is that screen fatigue that everyone's having.
The other factor, which I think might be possible, is the whole pricing structure of print books and ebooks, and in particular, the discounting that our largest online retailer does, making a hardcover that could sell for $25 sell for $15 when it's popular, and the ebook is $10. And you think, well, paper, $15, $10, I'll take the paperback. Right. I take the hardcover in paper because it's a better reading experience.
Sure. I mean, more over the last couple of years, what has grown as ebooks have gone down a bit is the audio format.
Yeah.
Because that is also off screen, but people are discovering not only that they can enjoy podcasts, but they can enjoy audiobooks, and that they can listen to audio while they're doing all sorts of other things.
Right.
They have capacity on their phones to download audiobooks, and they can have them with them for whenever it's convenient, in a car or while they're cooking or shopping. And the other thing that's driving the growth is the smart speakers. So when someone's listening to it used to be you'd have an audiobook on a cassette and you'd
right, it was terrible.
And you'd have to find, where did I leave off? And you try to bring it in the house.
Right.
And you're like, but the ability to just find your place easily and go from listening to your car, carry your groceries inside and say, hello, Alexa, keep playing that from where I left off in the car. And that's become very compelling.
Right. I think there is a place where technology has actually increased the opportunity, whereas ebooks did increase it, but then,
ebooks had a big change, but I think it was very different depending on the genre and type of book.
But a lot of it is the phone technology, the literal, the increase of smartphones and connectivity, ubiquitous internet. Phone integration with car is unbelievably powerful.
Yeah.
And that, as you say, you can move around your house. The headphones are really good now. Quality of the headphones is good. Phones can hold a million books, just an amazing amount of stuff. And, like people who run or walk or who exercise, instead of listening to music, can listen to a book.
Sure.
It's really powerful.
I'm glad it's a growing market. We certainly do all of our books as audiobooks as well, and ebooks and in every format. For me, maybe because I was read to as a child, I get very sleepy when I listen to an audiobook, which is not good for driving. But a great reader is an exception. I mean, there are a lot of great readers bringing
great
books
voice
to life.
Actors now who have migrated to reading and making that experience really interesting.
Yeah. So we had, I think, recently we had a book that we saw. Oh, we heard, your book, Sometimes I Lie, a thriller, is on the New York Times bestseller list. We said, oh my goodness, how great. And we looked and it was, the hardcover done nicely. The paper, and the ebook was doing nicely, even better. But this was the audio book that was on the bestseller list, on the audio list.
Right.
So again, we're starting to see within audio that certain genres are ahead of others. And the whole revival of the thriller as written often by women with female protagonists, untrustworthy narrators, voyeurism, heavy drinking, the whole thing, with a girl or wife in the title sometimes. I think that genre is very popular in audio. So go figure.
Yeah. Well, do you think that what do you foresee in the future for audiobooks? Just curious. Is that going to be – will publishers start – encouraging higher production values where maybe you have multiple readers, try to make it more dramatic? Or is that silly and really you just need the reader and the words?
It's interesting. The experimentation over the last 10 years in formats that kind of dramatized books or created – so there was the books that as apps and books as enhanced ebooks with all sorts of other – enhancements and sounds and bells and whistles, literally or figuratively. Those experiments came and went, like the CD-ROM came and went. And it turns out, it seems to keep turning out that when people want a book, they want, now they might want it as an audiobook, but the elaborateness is not actually appealing. It maybe gets attention for itself if it innovates in some way, But that's short-lived, and what people seem to keep coming back to is, if I want to watch a video, I want to watch a video. If I want to, you know, look at an illustrated book, I want to look at an illustrated book. If I want to hear a book, I want to hear the book. Now, within that, obviously, there's room for great talent. Jim Dale, with his hundreds of character voices for Harry Potter, it's not multiple readers, but he...
It's a great reader.
It's an unbelievable performance.
Yeah.
So, yeah, audio is up 20 or 30% over the last 3 years each year. So, you know, but the main thing is, if you're as a publisher, you want to publish, you want to make a book available in every possible format, because to every possible reader or listener who might want it in any format, you don't, it doesn't pay to have a bias. You know, you basically, to publish is to make public, and you, what you're trying to do is to get it in as many hands and as possible in any format it can keep going in. So the idea that, oh, you prefer ebooks or prefer physical books or audio as a publisher, you want to sell a book everywhere. You want to sell it in every form.
Right.
Yeah.
And make it available. Yeah. You, as little friction as possible.
That's the goal.
So we've talked a lot about fiction, as it is sort of ironically, because when you started Flatiron, it was meant to be a nonfiction house.
And we still have had a number of successes in nonfiction. The first book we published was Oprah Winfrey's What I Know for Sure, which combined the best things she'd written in a column she'd been writing for O Magazine for 15 years. And that was a great book to start with because of she's an up-and-coming name. And,
it's a
really wonderful book and very much emphasized its keepsake quality. The audio, which she read, is actually fantastic. At one point, someone comes to her door to cheer her up when she's feeling down and sings a old spiritual to her, and she sings it on the audio. So it really comes to life as an audio. But the book itself, we did with it's cloth bound and it has a ribbon marker, and it's made to be a keepsake. And it was great to start with that. It did extremely well. Our biggest book so far this year has been James Comey's book, A Higher Loyalty, which has sold 1 million copies, and you know it's a great nonfiction success. Our other big nonfiction success so far this year is a book called Factfulness by a guy named Hans Rosling, who sadly died of pancreatic cancer before we published. But he was very good friends with Bill Gates, and the Gates Foundation really relied on his whole nonprofit work with his company, where he looks at the difference between what the data shows versus our perceptions of what's going on around the world. And for the Gates Foundation, figuring out what's really happening and where, how to really move the needle has always been very important. And they had a very strong relationship with Hans Rosling. So when Hans Rosling died, Bill Gates did some incredible things to support the book and make it known. He wrote about it in his Gates Notes, which goes to 40 million people that first day we published, which was very generous. And then he made an incredible offer to give a free electronic copy to every college senior graduating in America this year. Now, only some of them came to pick it up, but quite a number did. And the publicity around the fact that he thought this book was so important that he wanted it in the hands of every graduating college senior who might possibly show up for it, got a lot of new publicity around the book and just pushed it along further. So that's been a great nonfiction bestseller that I think will go on for a long time.
It's got an interesting title, and I like your description of it. It made me want to read it. So,
well, the term, which, you know, the book was signed up by Will Schwalbe, our editor at large, who was obsessed with Hans Rosling after seeing his TED talk a couple years ago. That term and its meaning has gotten new relevance in a current political environment where the whole idea of true, what is a fact, the whole idea of alternative facts, what's real versus what's perceived, has become even more important.
Well, that's what I thought of. The idea of giving it to graduating seniors is probably purposeful in the sense of trying to restore the meaning of facts and information, but also remind people that we don't make up our own reality.
Yeah.
Except in the quantum physics form of making up our own reality.
Well, the book tries to, beyond showing you examples of how your perception of the world might be different than what's actually happening. It tries to teach you how to think that way. So I think that he, to your point, believed that this is an important skill. And it is a very, very interesting and educational book that I think people, if they go beyond just what they're learning from the book and use the ideas of how to interpret the world, then that would be a good thing.
So do you, as a publisher, do you feel that that's important, this notion of being in, because one could publish anything, you know, as a publisher, you have your choice of things to publish. Obviously, you want to publish books that people want to read, but within the context of that range, there's a lot to publish in. Do you have a sense that you have a role to play in the cultural and intellectual discourse of society as a publisher?
I mean, the idea that you could publish a successful book that actually might affect people's thinking is the ultimate dream. But first, you just try to find books of value out of everything that might be publishable. To find a book in nonfiction, for instance, you want to find a book that has a perceived audience, that has a person who has something new to say to that audience and has a way to articulate that message and maybe even get it heard. So those are a lot of hurdles to get over. And if you think that book actually can affect people's thinking, that's even more exciting. We hadn't in the beginning been thinking of ourselves as a publisher of topical material because the news cycle can benefit online writing and podcasts and magazines and journalism and television, sometimes in a way that books which are planned a year or two or three out on the horizon can't really compete with. However, we did break that rule. It wasn't really a rule, but we hadn't done anything topical or political until we had met with Vice President Biden to talk to him about his book about the year in which he was vice president, and also his son Beau was dying of a glioblastoma. And that was a very affecting personal book that we really were excited to publish. And then it turns out James Comey is, I think, an admirer of Vice President Biden. We ended up meeting with him and just finding him, in spite of the concerns about which side of the aisle his audience might be on, we just ended up finding that his values and his earnestness and his belief in values that transcended partisanship, whatever you believed or one way or the other about choices he made, the values he was talking about that he believed in were ones that we felt were very, would resonate. And luckily, we were right.
Did publishing that book cause you to have to increase security in your building?
Our security in our building it doesn't even deserve the word security. I mean, we certainly paid attention to it. We hid the books under the cookbooks and under some blankets in the publicity department. But I wouldn't think that in the real world that would count as security. And we were so lucky that book didn't leak sooner than it did. It got out 4 days before our publication date. Which actually worked in our favor because after some reviews that came out that were very positive a couple days before it was published, when it first leaked, our president started tweeting up a storm about it, and that drove our pre-orders through the roof. So we thank him for that.
I'm sure Bob Woodward feels the same way.
they've started with, I think, a million copies, and they're trying
but
to
I
get
was
more.
Actually thinking of a different form of security. I was wondering whether by having published Comey, you were at risk of some level of crazy people coming after you.
Yeah, we were worried about that, and the manuscript was protected in a way we don't usually protect, when we were mailing things back and forth, password protected and all that.
Right.
But in terms of security in the world of security, I sent him a photograph at one point of the security precautions we were taking in our warehouse, which were to isolate the books. Right. And there was black kind of a black curtain around them in the a separate place in the warehouse. And I sent him the photograph and said, look at, you know, here's what we're doing to, you know, ensure security. And he wrote back and said, oh, good thinking. There are spies and thieves everywhere. And I think he was kind of making fun of our, it's like, good luck with that.
Right.
But we were very worried about leaking ahead early because if it, you know, the news cycle is a very tight one. And we had, obviously, since he had not spoken until the book was published, and there was a lot of built up interest in what he would have to say about his whole career, not just, obviously, especially about his experience with President Trump, but the book is about his whole career. The only last three chapters are about his time with President Trump. And if it had leaked sooner, our whole – it could have been digested before it even happened, before even people really
– people wouldn't buy it because they feel like they'd already heard the story from media.
So that's very risky on any of these political topical books. However, it is – at the moment, all the media wants to talk about 24/7.
Yeah.
So you get the benefit of getting media, but you might get chewed also, you know, on the wrong side of that. It's a double-edged sword.
Well, I've heard from some people in publicity that for the average book, it's impossible to get any attention because of the attention that goes to the political cycle.
And it's not impossible, but it's gotten harder. I mean, we get a lot of attention for each of our books. And I think it does benefit, again, from having that smaller list because rather than have a publicist working on 10 books a month, that publisher is working on one or two that month and able to continue working on it for several, you know, time beyond the initial publication. So we've actually gotten a lot of publicity and generally very good reviews for most of what we've published. Not all, of course, but we've gotten a high benefit from having just the more time. I mean, you could benefit from even more time if you could figure out how to do it. And but I like the size that we're publishing in for that reason. There is more, relatively speaking, more time on books even that aren't even the most obvious big books being published. So we've tended to get a lot of publicity per book.
Right, which I think is I think that's actually a good lesson for other publishers that, you know.
Well, if only there were a formula that worked all the time, we would have all been doing it a long time ago. But, and you can fail under this approach and you can have success under others.
That's true.
And I've done some different ones. But this is just, I think it's more gratifying and I think it's better for authors. So that's what we're doing anyway.
And you're having fun.
It's been good. I mean, Macmillan has supported it from the beginning without hesitation, given us the ability to hire the best staff, sign up the best books, and just apply the belief that if with real editorial selectivity and rigor, combined with enormous energy and passion for publicizing and marketing the books at the other end, that it'll pay off. And we've had a number of good successes, and this year has been especially lucky. But we're well aware of how the wheel of fortune in publishing spins, so we don't take it for granted.
Well, and being successful can be sometimes a double-edged sword because the expectation now is you'll do as well again.
Right, which is it does increase the challenge, but and you know the. Without a much of a backlist since we've only been publishing for 4 years, and with only we have a few big brand names. Leon Moriarty happily followed Amy Einhorn to Flatiron, and we published her book Truly Madly Guilty 2 years ago, and we're this November 6th we're publishing her next book, Nine Perfect Strangers, and you know to have an author with that size of a reputation and audience is enormously helpful. But most of our books are new material.
Right.
So until we build more of a stable of repeat authorship, which we've started to do, it takes time to accumulate enough repeat authorship and backlist that you're not completely dependent or as dependent on the rise and fall of individual bets.
So you have not been tempted to buy someone's backlist?
there just aren't backlists sitting out there for the plucking, sadly, because the value of those backlists is clear to anyone.
Right.
And they're if they're available, they're not available.
Right. I got it. Well, thank you, Bob. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me. And
you're welcome.
It was really
it's been
fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been good.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about publishing. I've been talking to Bob Miller, who is the president of Flatiron Books and who has been a spectacular guest. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having me.